An out-of-whack budget and how the Russians took a cue from corporate America. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, October 3rd. Thanks for joining us. It's been nearly 2 weeks since Hurricane Maria tore through Puerto Rico, and still residents are struggling to get basic supplies. Food, water, some 95% of people are still without power. Today, President Trump made his first trip to survey the damage and do a little backpatting for the federal response.
You can be very proud. Everybody around this table and everybody watching can really be very proud of what's taken place in Puerto Rico.
He also said this.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives.
Those costs are likely just the tip of things. We don't have a dollar figure yet on how much aid the feds might send. By some estimates, recovery in Puerto Rico will cost upwards of $30 billion. And it's far from the only thing on the table in D.C. with big budgetary implications. Really big. Take the GOP tax plan. White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney was on Fox News Sunday talking about the tax framework. He said it would be okay if the tax plan added to the deficit, claiming it would spur economic growth.
If we simply look at this as being deficit neutral, you're never going to get the type of tax reform and tax reductions that you need to get to sustained 3% economic growth.
Deficit neutral. Let's take a second and explain what deficit neutral means. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Deficit neutral. It sounds simple, and it is. In the case of the Republican tax plan, deficit neutral means the plan wouldn't add to the deficit, despite huge tax cuts.
But you do get dragged into the swamp.
Not that swamp, says Bob Bixby, head of the Concord Coalition, a deficit watchdog group. The swamp he's talking about, the pool of gimmicks politicians resort to so they can claim something is deficit neutral, like...
The tax cut is going to juice the economy by so much that we'd actually end up paying for itself.
That's what White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney was talking about over the weekend. Bixby says he's never seen that happen. But there are other tricks. Make your tax plan deficit neutral for just 10 years. Jacob Liebenluft of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities explains that one.
You might be encouraged to use gimmicks that reduce the deficit impact in that 10-year period, but explode the deficit afterwards.
And you can always trade out official government estimates of economic growth for your own, so you can justify deficit spending by saying it'll eventually be erased because the economy will be growing. And that means the government will take in more tax money and won't have to spend as much on benefits. Michael Strain is an economist at the conservative American Enterprise Institute.
Then food stamp spending goes down and the deficit goes down too.
Strain says one way to avoid the gimmicks altogether, make the tax plan bipartisan so both parties have to sign on to it. Like the last time there was tax reform in 1986. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Trump administration makes no bones about favoring fossil fuels over renewables and has been pushing back hard against power plant regulations. But there's a rule out there known as the Clean Power Plan that's going to be especially hard to eliminate. Not that that's stopping the White House from trying. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports from Washington.
It'll take a lot to kill the regulatory zombie of the Clean Power Plan. That is, the rules cutting carbon emissions from power plants. The Supreme Court halted its rollout, but the EPA can't sit on its hands. It's bound by its own finding that greenhouse gases are dangerous, and it has to act. Brendan Collins at the law firm Ballard Spahr advises power plants and oil and gas companies.
The big money is on the administration putting together some sort of weak tea version of the Clean Power Plan to take its place, declare itself as having fulfilled its obligations, then move on to other issues.
To ditch the current regulation, the EPA has to make a case. Now, one could be that the plan is too costly. But law professor Jack Linke at NYU says the costs of decarbonizing are falling as renewable energy and natural gas are getting cheaper. So this administration
will have to grapple with these recent emission trends that show costs are actually even lower than it originally thought. It can't just offer a kind of a one-sentence document that says we're repealing the Clean Power Plan because we feel like it.
But this coal-friendly EPA could also just drag its feet. Even then, competition is forcing coal plants to shut down. Joseph Goffman of Harvard's Environmental Law Program helped to craft the Clean Power Plan.
It is a setback if the rules are changed, but almost no matter what the EPA does at this point, it can't really neutralize those market forces.
So, one way or another, U.S. emissions are falling and will likely keep falling. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today had the wind in its sails. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. On Monday, Facebook handed over 3,000 Russian-linked ads to congressional investigators, ads that give us just a glimpse into the scope of meddling in the presidential election. Now, the Washington Post has a story that Russian operatives used a sophisticated Facebook advertising tool to identify and target voters. For more, we have the Washington Post's national technology reporter, Craig Timberg, with us. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
We've known that Russian operatives created political ads to influence this election. What more do we know now?
Well, you know how when you look at a pair of shoes and every time you go anywhere else on the internet, you see that pair of shoes?
I do.
That's what the Russians did. They used this special Facebook tool called Custom Audiences that allows them to match up your behavior, identify who you are, and then follow you around the internet. So if you were looking at some sort of crazy conspiracy theory link, they learned that you might be interested in that kind of content, and they kept targeting it at you.
So tell me a little bit more about this tool. It's called Custom Audiences. Who is it created for, and how does it work?
It's essentially the advertising tool for corporate America. So if Target wants to upload a bunch of customer lists and deliver Target ads to people, they can do that. If a big oil company wants to deliver its messages, they can do that. It's a pretty high-powered tool that Facebook has developed in the last 5 years or so that helps companies really find people who would be open to their kinds of messages. And political campaigns use it too. We just didn't know that the Russians were using it as a political tool.
What's it mean that the Russians were using it? If somebody clicked on an ad, the Russians got them in this list of users who might be susceptible to this kind of propaganda. What would that mean about how this ad would spread?
So it isn't only ads. It also can be links on Facebook pages that might lead you to, say, you know, a Russian-operated website. And once you go outside of Facebook, they actually can attach a bunch of cookies to you and follow you around the web and learn what you're interested in, learn what you're reading. And then the term of art is retargeting. They can retarget the same sort of content to you again and again wherever you go on the internet over the course of months at a time.
Could they also target my friends?
Yeah. So if you clicked on something or you followed a link, they might reasonably assume that your friends or your friends' friends would be interested in the same sort of content. Maybe you're the kind of person who thought that Hillary Clinton's health was really important to you during the election. And so someone operating an information campaign would think, oh, well, your friend probably is interested in that same sort of content. And so they would it would spread across your social network potentially. We now know that Facebook has modeled this, and they say that 10 million people saw the Russian bot ads on their social media platform.
Mark Zuckerberg has promised to do more to stop the spread of fake news, fake ads. The company is working with congressional investigators. What more can Facebook do now with this investigation or going forward?
Folks on the Hill feel like there could be some sort of deeper dives analytically, not only into sort of Facebook usage and the way ads were displayed, but also in the way the Facebook links outward to the larger world, to things like YouTube and Twitter. You know, it's a big, complex ecosystem of internet platforms now. And the only people who really understand it are the people at the companies because you know, even independent researchers can't see how Facebook works, can't see how Facebook necessarily connects with YouTube. So the people on the Hill think that Facebook could go farther in turning its gaze inward in a more powerful way.
What are the implications here for other social media? What do we know about how and to what extent Russians targeted those platforms?
I think it's safe to assume that anything that any of us use was probably targeted at least a little bit. Facebook was just – I think it's clearer than ever really that Facebook was one tool among many in that effort, and they used it the way a U.S. political campaign or a U.S. corporate advertiser might use it. They use it to find people, to target them, to alter or influence their view of reality. I think they did everything that they could think of to shape the political field during that election.
Washington Post national technology reporter Craig Timberg, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
A whole lot of people and a whole lot of jobs in the Southwest rely on water from the Colorado River. According to a 2014 University of Arizona study, the river adds in the neighborhood of $840 billion to the economies of Arizona and California. But the region's in a long-running drought, and water shortages pose a threat to local economies. Now, lawmakers in Phoenix are experimenting with new ways to conserve. Carrie Young reports.
This summer, the big item on the Phoenix City Council agenda was water.
Okay, we have a motion in favor of the proposal. We have a second. Let's do a roll call.
After 17 years of drought, water levels in the region's major reservoir have fallen close to shortage declaration lines, and council members are considering a relatively new way of dealing with it.
Gallego.
Yes.
Nowakowski.
Yes.
Stark.
Yes.
Valenzuela.
Yes.
In the past, Phoenix mainly entered into water agreements that dealt with storage to build up its savings. But this time, council members are being asked to approve $2 million to compensate the nearby Gila River Indian community. In return, the tribe will agree not to use a significant portion of its water supply this year. Stephen Rowe Lewis is the tribe's governor.
Hopefully, the community can be a guiding star, you know, for all of these important entities within Arizona to look at the importance of drought conservation.
The agreement passed Phoenix City Council unanimously, meaning this year the city, the state, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and the Walton Family Foundation will team up to pay the Gila River Indian community a total of $7 million if the tribe leaves 13 billion gallons of its allotted water supply in the Colorado River Reservoir known as Lake Mead.
Water is the foundation of public health, economic opportunity, and quality of life in a desert city. We can't afford to fail.
That's Phoenix Water Services Director Catherine Sorensen. She says this kind of agreement is pretty innovative because so many parties from federal and local governments, even the private sector, are working together to find ways to voluntarily leave water in the system.
That helps build water levels in Lake Mead. It helps forestall shortages, and it really benefits the entire region.
While $7 million may seem significant, past trends suggest the tribe could have secured more if the state chose a different option, like banking water in a tribal underground aquifer system for credit from the state. David DeYoung helped engineer the Gila River Indian Community's aquifer recharging system. He's standing at the edge of what looks like a large pond on the reservation. He compares water banking to a savings account.
So we try to put a little money away each year so that when we need that money, we can start drawing it out.
The Gila River Indian community also had the option of leasing its water supplies to nearby cities and towns. Still, Tribal Governor Lewis says with no end in sight for this drought, both tribal and city officials agreed they had to try something new.
We don't squander water. Water is going to be as precious as oil and gold, and even more so in the future. And this was in line with our cultural teachings.
Lewis adds his tribe knows what it's like to go without water. In the 1800s, their farming economy was devastated when communities and industry upstream dried up the tribe's natural access to water from the Gila River. Righting that wrong didn't fully happen until 2004, thanks to a massive water settlement.
This is something that no people, no population, whether indigenous or non-native, should go through.
He explains the real goal of the deal with Phoenix is to lead by example so that others in the region might also consider more innovative solutions to weathering this drought. In Sacatone, Arizona, I'm Carrie Young for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you know, I've been the Larry David of food, right? It's just like, curb your enthusiasm here, guys. Let's just look at the science.
A culinary change of attitude. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 84 points, 0.3% to close at 22,641. The Nasdaq closed up 14 points, 0.2% to finish at 6531. And the S&P 500 jumped 5 points, 0.2% to end at 2534. Tesla failed to meet production goals for its new electric sedan, making just 260 of the 1,500 cars it promised. But the stock still ended high today. Tesla revved up 1.9%. Walmart made a move in its high-stake battle against Amazon. It bought a delivery company called Parcel. Walmart rang up 0.9%. Bonds rose today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. It's not cheap to put solar panels on the roof of your house. It can cost thousands of dollars, and that puts solar out of reach for many low-income homeowners. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Emily Jones reports on one city's effort to make solar more affordable.
Gail Hutchinson lives in a 100-year-old house right on the outside edge of Brunswick, Georgia's historic district. She fell in love with the place when she bought it 20 years ago. But old houses aren't very energy efficient, and South Georgia is hot, which makes for a steep electric bill.
Before I quit using the air conditioner, I only use it on hot days, it was running about $250 a month.
Hutchinson is semi-retired and lives on about $1,200 a month.
And you put $250 out for electricity, and then you make a mortgage payment, and then you want to do other things. Like I said, it gets down to the point, well, are you going to pay a bill or are you going to eat?
So she cut her monthly bill to about $80 by going without air conditioning in a city where it's routinely at least 90 degrees through several months of the year. A lot of people in Brunswick are sweating high energy bills. About 41% of people here live below the federal poverty line, which for this area is about $1,600 a month. The city's economic and community development director, Travis Stiegel, thinks there's help for many of them behind the city's public works building, where a few empty acres sit growing weeds.
So we're going to take that and turn it into a field of dreams.
He's not thinking of a baseball field.
This will give us the opportunity to actually erect our solar installation and give us all the opportunity in the world.
Stiegel is part of a local team trying to tackle one question. How do you get solar energy to low and moderate income communities? Amit Ronan of George Washington University's Solar Institute says the answer is tough.
The trick is you have to pay for a lump sum up front, a capital to basically buy the system, and there's no further cost after that. Sunshine is free. But how do you get that lump sum up front in order to get those benefits long term?
Securing that funding is extra difficult if you don't make much money, so putting solar panels on the roof is generally not an option. The team in Brunswick got a little help when it won $15,000 in seed money in June from the Department of Energy as part of the Solar in Your Community Challenge, and the project could qualify for more. Stiegel plans to use the money to put up solar panels on that unused field and sell the power to the local utility, Georgia Power, for a rebate.
We take those rebated funds, and now with those funds, we subsidize the energy costs.
The grant will only cover about a quarter of the cost of the panels, but Stiegel hopes to keep the price down by bringing in more partners, like companies, to provide and install the panels. And he says even with the project still in the planning stages, it's drawing businesses to town.
There's something about energy. When you are known to be energy friendly, companies start to call. We've had 5 companies so far.
But it's unclear whether other low-income cities can replicate this kind of project that requires upfront investment. So far, only a handful of communities and local utilities are giving it a try. In Brunswick, Georgia, I'm Emily Jones for Marketplace.
You might recognize the name Christopher Kimball if you've watched America's Test Kitchen. You know, the tall, thin guy with the bow tie. Or if, like me, you've read and cooked from Cooks Illustrated magazine. Kimball and his team were known for perfecting recipes. If you follow along exactly, you'll cook something really good. But Kimball has started a new cooking venture now, a multimedia company called Milk Street, with a website, TV show, podcast, and a cookbook. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been writing and publishing recipes for pretty much decades now. How has the way we cook at home changed in that time?
It's about to totally change. You know, it used to be that traditionally American cooking was Northern European. And that's a very particular style of cooking, which was heavy on technique. And that's not really how most of the world cooks. So we're going from a Northern European technique-based culinary tradition to one where it's just about flavor. If you think about it, this whole idea of mastering the art, right, of the technique to develop flavor is unnecessary in a world where you have the option of buying foods with very strong flavors at the outset.
You say it's about to change. Why aren't we there yet?
Home cooking is the last bastion of the old guard. And that's because people get into a routine. Maybe their parents cooked a certain way or that they're used to a certain style of cooking. So changing people's personal habits is harder than changing where they eat.
So I've spent a lot of years reading and cooking from Cooks Illustrated. And one of the things that struck me about Milk Street is how much less buttoned up it is. It seems to me sort of less focused on making the perfect version of something. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. We don't test the recipe 40 or 50 times anymore. I mean, maybe I'm having my third midlife crisis or something. I'm just letting it go. I think that we're trying to spend our time and energy on the front end. So lob lobby, for example, sort of a chickpea soup with stale bread from Northern Africa. Well, it's the concept of the recipe that's so intriguing. And there are hundreds of variations in that theme. So there's no really best version of that. We're just trying to create a version that works best in the American home kitchen, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it seems freeing in some ways to be focused on here's a great dish that you may not have had. You know, there's no need. The perfection piece of it is not there.
There is a joy in this kind of cooking. I'm cooking so much more in the last few years. There is a joy to this food because it's about big flavors and it's a new way of thinking about cooking. Let me give you an example. In Japan, when you cook, it's almost how you move in the kitchen. Now, there's a certain way to move. In Vietnam, there's the right intent, a very Buddhist philosophy in cooking. So cooking in other parts of the world isn't just the instruction. Cooking is performance art, right? And I have been, you know, I've been the Larry David of food, right? It's just like, curb your enthusiasm here, guys. Let's just look at the science. Look, I still love the science, but there's an enthusiasm to this project because I've realized after all these years, you know, the doors have opened and there's other places in the world have so many better ways of preparing food, or at least different ways.
As the recipe repertoire of a home cook shifts as we sort of enter this new big flavor world that you're describing, what's it mean for the food industry today, both publishing but wider than that?
Look, I think the food industry is all over this and has been all over it for years. I mean, the restaurant business is at the front end of this. And I've always said, you know, if you want to see what's going on in the restaurant world, look at airports, right? I mean, I was just in Atlanta. There's a place called Aviva in a food court in Atlanta, which has a line out the door. I mean, there was a 20-minute line. And it's, you know, a shawarma and it's falafel, et cetera. And when you see that next to the fried chicken place and the hamburger place, and this is the place getting all the business, what does that tell you? I think the country's ahead of us. I think it's already happened.
Christopher Kimball, thanks so much.
Yeah, my great pleasure. Thank you.
This final note before we go. Richard Smith, the former head of Equifax, was on the Hill today in front of a congressional panel apologizing for the data breach, which we know now affected 145.5 million of us. He answered questions about how it happened, who knew what when. Congress is considering creating additional rules for corporate hacks, oversight. And then there was this idea floated by Republican Joe Barton of Texas.
But it would seem to me that you might pay a little bit more attention to security if you had to pay everybody whose account got hacked couple of thousand bucks or something?
145.5 million accounts times a couple thousand bucks. Yeah, that's a lot of zeros. Today, the Dow rose 84 points, 0.3% to close at 22,641. The Nasdaq closed up 14 points, 0.2% to finish at 6531. And the S&P 500 jumped 5 points, 0.2% to end at 2534. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Adrienne Hill. Kai will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.